great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects here in our state with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. He has been, I don't know, I was thinking of a regular on this show for I don't even know how many years. It's been a long time. He's a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. But he still comes by to talk with us about bugs, and I hope you'll join in with your questions for Phil. Tell us about the ant swarms you've seen near your home. What are your remedies for dealing with infestations? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email with maybe an insect photo or a question. Do that to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be back. So, Larry, I think it's close to 45 years.
Oh, my goodness me. That is a long time for two guys to talk on the radio.
Yes.
And a lot of times we talked about ants, and let's talk about them again. It's kind of common, I think, to see ant swarms in late summer afternoons, and what's going on there?
So, you know, we can kind of tell what kind of ant it is by when it swarms, and that's when all the wing forms come out. And as we get into late summer, the ants that are out in the yard, either cornfield ants or what we call field ants, often will swarm in the late afternoons. And so versus something like carpenter ants, which are much earlier in the spring. So those are the kind of ants, you know, other than the cornfield ants come in the house once in a while for sugar, but they're really not more than a minor nuisance. And interesting phenomena. It might go on 3 or 4 days in a row at the same time and then be gone.
Hmm. What role do ants play in our ecosystem?
Well, you know, sometimes things that you wouldn't even think about. There have been studies of field ants in prairies where their excavation of the soil and moving things up and down are very important for the nutrient cycle for the plants. Now, in general, ants either feed on insects, and a lot of those are harmful insects, so that's a beneficial side. Other ants tend to milk aphids and go for nectar sources and the like. So that you could even argue in some cases they can be pollinators. So they have an awful lot of things going on that we really don't think about. You just think about them running around the kitchen and creating a nuisance most of the time.
Yeah, and speaking of that, should we try to remove them when, you know, you see one in the house?
Well, the issue is those are sterile females. I mean, if you're dealing with ants, the secret is to find the nest and take care of the queen because she's the mother of all the ants you see. So, yeah, you really don't worry about it. And it doesn't, you don't gain much by killing the ants that come in. Sometimes you can see a trail of ants, which kind of suggests where they're coming in from, and you can make adjustments, whether you spray or seal things up. Or what would be more important is to trail that trail back to see where it goes in the ground. If you're to treat something, that would be one option. The other one is if you match a bait that's made for ants to either sweet feeding or protein feeding ants, that depends which they like, they will take the bait back to the nest and thereby hypothetically killing the queen. So for ant problems, baiting is the best thing to do. Sometimes people spray along the outside of the foundation, and that really doesn't kill the ants as much as it repels them. It kind of breaks their habit. But more than likely than not, if you don't treat the nest, they will be back.
John in Greendale has a question about ants. Let's go there. John, hi.
Hi. Hi. Well, this is sort of what you're talking about. I have, in most of the rooms in my house, I will see one or two or three ants every day on the floor, on the wall. It does not appear like they're going after any food. They're just walking around. And I have yet to figure out where they're coming in. And I'm wondering if I just hire an exterminator, you know, are they just going to blast everything? Can I find an ant-specific exterminator that knows what they're doing?
Hmm.
Well, so when I would get this call, the kind of questions I ask is, how big are the ants? What color are they? And are they seasonal? I mean, if you see ants in January, that points a whole different direction to us than just seeing in a couple. The ants you're seeing, I think, are just looking for food, foraging. You know, pest control firms, I think, have become far more professional than when I started, because it used to be they would spray everything in sight, and that doesn't necessarily, in fact, I used to tease sometime, it was like rabbit hunting with a tank. It just seemed to be overkill. Now, depending how frustrated you are, there are certain sprays that can be applied to the outside of the house that honestly will solve most problems. It's just a question if you want to go through the expense of having somebody come to do it. And once a year is more than sufficient. In your case, you know, you've been making observations. There's still no pattern. But one thing you might consider, you know, it depends how much a detective you want to be, but, you know, you can put a little bit of honey or something sweet on a piece of wax paper, put a little bit of cooking oil, put it out in the kitchen, because that's where the ants more likely are going to be looking for food, and see if you can attract enough of them that, again, you get a pattern. Now, I'll warn you, some ants are more active at night than during the day, and so it's more better to look at 10 o'clock at night and maybe not necessarily noon, but that would be one way of getting a little more information. If they really get frustrating, you always catch a couple ants and send it down to the diagnostic lab at UW-Madison, and PJ will take a look. Because if we know what kind of ant it is, first of all, they have certain nesting habits, and they also have food preferences, and those two things often lead us in a little more direct math of trying to control them. So, but you know, for what's going on for you, it's, you know, doesn't sound like anything I would worry about other than the nuisance value, and they don't even seem to be interested enough in your house to be a major problem, because you might experience, you know, somebody spills pop on the floor, you forget to clean it up completely. All of a sudden, the next day, there are hundreds of ants. Well, those have been recruited from outside once the food source is gone, and sometimes just cleaning up the food source, the ants stop coming in.
Yeah. John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Betty in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Betty.
Great. Good morning. I'm having trouble with... I've had it for a number of years. Around the end of July, I start getting tiny little bites. They start out small, and there might be three in a cluster, and then the area turns red. Then the middle of the bite sometimes weeps a little bit. It gets a little bit necrotic right in a tiny place in the middle of the bite. And I never see them come. And they're either on the outside, or they slip under a pair of pants, or they slip behind my ear. I don't know what they are.
So you
do you spend a lot of time outdoors? Do you like to garden
yeah,
you know, just hike?
Quite a bit. No, gardening.
Okay.
But I seem to get them. I don't know when they bite me, because I don't notice them right away. It takes a while for them to start to itch.
Sure. So what this sounds like is what we would call classic chigger bites. And chiggers are little mites. But the problem, and there's a couple problems, is one, chiggers are small enough you don't see them, but usually they have already left you before you start to react. They are insect parasites by nature, but that doesn't stop them from burrowing into people. A classic thing is to have the bites weep. Another classic thing is they often seem to be confined around where clothing is confined, sock lines, pant lines, those kind of things, although you can find them anywhere. And talking to the new improved Phil, which is what I call PJ, who runs the diagnostic lab now, you know, chiggers have been up, and we have experienced that before in dry years, so this year might be particularly bad. And you may expect the reaction to be a day or two after you're outside, so people often don't correlate that. So a couple thoughts. It does help when you're out in the garden for a while and in areas that you've had problems. When you come in, take your clothes off, go take a shower, and do a brisk toweling off, because what you're physically doing then is removing the mites before they get a chance to burrow in. The other frustration with this is when you feel the reaction, that like, they're already gone. So it's not as if you know, there used to be an old home remedy of putting nail polish on the bites and whatnot, and it really didn't do any good, per se. If they get particularly frustrating, honestly, some of the clothing treatments that we put on to repel ticks will also take care of chiggers. But the problem is then you've got to wear long pants. I mean, you can't put that stuff on your skin. It wouldn't hurt to put it on the socks and shoes, but it doesn't guarantee you protection. But, you know, in particular, raspberry patches seem to be a heaven for chiggers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times you get in that kind of thick stuff, people run into it. But as I said, the way you describe it, it really fits what I would call chigger bites, and they are very frustrating to diagnose because, as I said, this delay and the critters are small enough. They're little reddish mites. If you saw one on a white piece of paper, you could probably tell there's something there, but they're not very easy to see.
Betty, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. On to Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Larry. So my question for your guest is, I haven't noticed as many yellow jackets and hornets this summer, especially later in the summer here, even at like the scrapyard. I guess I was wondering if your guest had any insight as to why that might be.
Yeah, I mean, you always see some activity. In general, spring weather seems to have the biggest effect on yellow jacket populations. The ones that nest in the ground are very susceptible to drowning out and the like. The ones above ground, maybe not so much, but the like. And so, you know, if I go back historically, back in the 80s and 90s, we just had a very significant problem with German yellow jacket. That's the critter that shows up in August and September when you're trying to eat and drink outdoors. And they get in contact with food and spill pop and whatnot. And so because of that close association, people get a lot of stings. And that was a new introduction from Europe back in the 70s and 80s. So it just went crazy those first few years. And the point, I mean, I had principals tell me a third of their kids got stung, you know, the first day of school. It was just atrocious. But interesting enough, their populations have been in major decline for the last 10 to 15 years, which is kind of typical of an invasive critter. So, you know, that one I always identified as the number one yellow jacket problem that we would run into. As I said, their numbers have been dramatically down, so that might be part of it. But I also watch spring weather. And in the very bad yellow jacket years, we start to get problems even by the end of July with this, you know, showing up at picnics. In very quiet years, usually you don't get into this problem of eating and drinking outdoors till you get well into September. So I'm leaning on that side of things the way it's going. Although the last couple days I've bumped into a couple yellow jackets showing up, but in general, as I said, compared to what I remember, the frustration we'd have at county fairs and outdoor restaurants and whatnot, it's nothing now like it was years ago because of what happened with this German yellow jacket.
There you go, Marcus. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take a call from Kay in Sac de Sac. Hi, Kay.
Hi. My sister lives in a community that has closed their compost site for pickup. Probably 6 weeks ago, they've apparently found jumping worms. Now, my sister took a couple of truckloads of wood chip mulch and also of compost for raised beds, and I wondered what people who took stuff prior to this announcement should be looking for or could do.
Well, unfortunately, the could do is relatively minor. There are no products registered for treating worms. They used to use some, I remember it was a tea tree oil, but it's just not practical. It's too expensive and it's not marketed that way and the like. It's kind of a wait and see to see if they establish or not. It's really quite interesting. We experienced jumping worms for the first time probably about 10 years ago, 8 to 10 years ago. And, you know, it was unfortunately a kind of a depressive moment from my standpoint because I had to tell my neighbors who also had them. But since then, to be honest, relatively quiet. I mean, I can't tell you I saw a jumping worm in any of my gardening yet in the garden this year. I will tell you that our mulch disappears quicker, which would be suggestive they're there because that's part of their game of degrading stuff and the like. I will also tell you, and my wife and I have a minor disagreement on this, but I don't know if I've seen anything I would identify as plant injury because of it. She's got a couple spots where the plants don't do well, but digging into her, I don't see the jumping worms. So that's why I, as I said, I'm not signed on that that's the problem. So cross your fingers. If she does have them, you've got to be careful, of course, when you share plants and soil with other people because you don't want to transport it that way. But like my comments before about invasive critters, I have a feeling that jumping worms are going to be most problematic when they first get into your garden. And as I said, in our case, within 3 to 4 years, they really did settle down dramatically, and I can't give you a good reason why.
Kay, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Lyman in McFarland has a question for you, Phil. Let's go there.
Hi. I'd like to know how frequently people actually get bit by spiders. I have a lot of people who tell me they woke up in the morning and they had a couple of big welts and, you know, things like that. And it's always blamed on spiders. And I have no idea whether that's true or not.
Sure. So the data that I'm familiar with suggests at least 95% of what's presented as spider bites in emergency rooms is not. Spiders by nature don't go around biting. Honestly, many spiders can't get their fangs out enough to bite you. And definitely they don't run across the room to bite you. They have to be kind of in a confined space and react that way. So we find a lot of times, sometimes it's other insect bites, sometimes it's bacterial infections. I mean, there's all kinds of things that can present in a similar manner, and it's just that we tend to kind of lean that way. Multiple bites, I just don't expect it. That's just not the way spiders work when you see that. And the way we would verify it, and this gets kind of subtle, but if you were to magnify the wound, you should see a double puncture mark because they have two fangs. If you only see one puncture mark, it's got to be something else. No way it could be a spider. And sometimes you can't see the puncture marks. But now, that said, spiders are capable. I know I have bit. I have had colleagues been bit. But it's a very rare occurrence as far as my experience goes. And as I said, so most of the time, something else is involved there.
Lyman, there you go. Thanks so much for joining in. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Our guest today as we talk insects, you can join in too. Email to ideas@wpr.org or phone 1-800-642-1234. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, talking insects with him. Lots of callers online, lots of emails. We had an email from Ann. I don't know if you had a chance to see the picture of the spider.
Sure, and it was very helpful that Ann had a ruler next to the spider, so I can tell it's a big one. It's one of two things. I can't see enough detail. It's either a wolf spider or a related critter we call a fishing spider. And fishing spiders don't have to be next to water, but they are among the largest spiders we have in the state. I think if Ann were to use those and do a search of images, she'll be able to see. For many of the fishing spiders, they have a banding on the legs and stuff. But as I said, it's one of the two. And the bottom line, big and ugly, but harmless. They are, in both cases, nighttime hunting spiders. They're wandering around looking for prey at night, which sometimes means they wander into your house. Now, that's not good habitat for them to breed. Honestly, they're very slow breeding. Many of those have a couple-year life cycle. And nothing to worry about there. In fact, the argument would be as a bunch of them get in, there's got to be something you can seal or tighten up so something this large doesn't have that easy access to the house. But nothing to worry about.
Ellen in Neosho will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ellen.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I have a large, about 3.5 inch long, 1 inch in diameter caterpillar on the oak tree above my deck. It's been sitting there on this limb for about a week. It's systematically eating oak leaves very slowly. And I'm wondering, is this a Luna moth? It's segmented. It has tiny red spots in each segment. What can you tell me?
Well, it's definitely one of the wild silkworm caterpillars. Now, Luna isn't quite patterned that way. It doesn't sound like Cecropia, which is another big one. It could be Polyphemus, but there's a couple other ones. But I would look under wild silkworm caterpillars, and I think very quickly you will see something that matches that pattern, because and they're all big green worms in one form or another, but some have different colored knobs and whatnot, and that's what we use to identify them. The way things go, they will spin a cocoon down. Depending on the species, some will spin the cocoon in the tree twigs. Others will crawl to the ground and do it in the leaf litter. But in all cases, this late in the game, these critters will not emerge as adult moths until next year. And so they have to go through the cold cycle and in warming up in the spring, and then they reemerge. I'm a little interested in oak because, cherry and whatnot are far more prone to wild silkworms than oaks, but some of these do have a broad range. So, whether it's going to be Polyphemus, I don't think it's be Promethea because they tend to be more cherry related. But as I said, do a search on wild silkworm caterpillars, and you'll find one that matches that pattern. Lunas tend to be a little bit more walnut type of plants that they get on. Real neat critters when you see the adults. You're very short-lived. The adults do not even feed. They make great food for bats, unfortunately, and that's why you don't tend to see them very often. They don't live very long. But so you even have the option, if you're interested, in collecting the critter and let it spin a cocoon in a container. If you did that, you'd have to leave it out in the garage or someplace that goes through a normal cooling process. Or, again, you might have a neighborhood kid that's very interested in these kind of things, and might be nice to pass that on.
Yeah, there you go, Ellen. Thank you for calling. Helen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ellen.
Well, hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm calling because about a month ago, my cousin was bitten, got this bite, and it turns out it was a brown recluse spider that bit her, and it turned really pretty ugly up on her and on her shoulder. And she was thinking that she couldn't figure out where it happened, but she was breaking down a bunch of boxes and thinks maybe she got them that way if they were imported.
A quick question. Who did the diagnosis?
A doctor. She went to the clinic, and she had a huge area about the size of a softball that was red. And then inside that, there was an area where the skin had, died there.
Sure. Well, that definitely fits the pattern. The only reason I ask is, I did see recluse in my career here. I know I could take you to places where they live in Wisconsin, but they're very infrequent. But studies have shown us that better than 70% of the cases that were diagnosed as recluse turn out to be a bacterial skin infection and nothing to do with the spider. And it gets problematic of trying to point the finger. This is a classic. If we lived in Arkansas where recluse are very common, it would be more likely. I'm not saying that this was not, but, recluse, the name refers, the spider is really very shy, and it often will live in wall voids and other places. Now, if one is in your shoe and you put your foot in there, that's where we start to see the potential interaction. So with that said, could it come from boxes? Yes. If it came from places outside of Wisconsin, it's more likely. Because as I said, other than I can probably name on one hand the places I know where recluse are technically breeding in the state, which is an interesting question. We know they get shipped up here all the time on goods, but they don't take hold. And I don't understand what that is. They're more of a southern spider. Although, as I said, I know of two or three places in Madison that I confirmed, Ripon, Janesville. There are some communities that we've had little problematic spots. But interesting enough, it isn't so much that people get bit. We just know the spiders are there. And you come back 2 years later and you can still catch spiders and people are still not getting bit. So as I said, I'm always a little reluctant. I can't rule it out, but because at least the research that I'm aware of would suggest more often than not it's one of these necrotic bacteria that eat your skin, which is exactly the kind of reaction you get from recluse too, and that's why it's so hard to diagnose.
Oh, Helen, thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. Tom and Nina, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a trout fisherman, and I'm concerned about the overall decline of bugs in the terrestrial environment because if they're declining there, they're probably also declining in my trout streams. I'm concerned about the use of notonecticide type of herbicides on seed treatments in Wisconsin. I know there's one DNR scientist that's beginning to look into it from an aquatic invertebrate perspective, but what can we be doing to better understand the role of the herbicide, and what can we be doing to make people aware and then get regulations in place to protect our terrestrial bugs? Because I drive down the roads, I don't even have to clean my windshields anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely has been a number of studies that have pointed to worldwide, this is not just here, of declining in insect populations. Although interesting enough, the conversation, and I would tell you I've experienced the same thing on my car, but I have read studies that suggest the way the cars are engineered and the like, they don't collect the bugs that they did back in the day, and so that's part of it. Now, the product you said is not herbicide. It's technically an insecticide, and it's used to protect the seed from various seed-attacking insects. I will tell you that some of the environmentally problematic uses that used to be there are taken. EPA has, you know, verified it and pulled it away. But they're looking more at the short term. Honeybees and other pollinator protectants and whatnot has been more influenced of what they have taken off the market than this potential of any chemical that has a relatively long life, meaning it doesn't break down quickly, has this chance of getting in places it doesn't belong. And that's what's happening to the nicotinoids in particular. There are scientists looking at this, even within EPA. It's a constant point of discussion. How much impact does this have versus half a dozen other things you could point to? We all have the personal choice what we can use in our own yards. There are nicotinoid-like products that are used that, you know, if you're not comfortable with it, you can, decide not to use it. Where it gets more problematic is when you get in these agricultural settings where the cost-benefit that they're looking at, they tend to lean to think that it isn't causing enough of a widespread problem. I will tell you, in particular, to trout streams, the one thing, I had a professor by the name of Bill Hilsenhoff, who was an aquatic entomologist and was really one of the founding members that started working with insects in water and how they would tell you how good a water quality we have. Because back in the 60s and 70s, honestly, the insecticides had far more negative impacts than they do now. And the interesting thing is that, the cleaning up of our waterways has, in general, overall improved stream quality. So we're seeing in the aquatic environment, the things that are living in the water are doing better. Now, unfortunately, when you get in the terrestrial environment, among other things, the large adjustments we're making to the landscape, the way we farm and whatnot, rather than having a more diverse landscape, has an awful lot to do with why we're suffering so much. Because to be honest, a 100-acre cornfield, I can give you about half a dozen bugs that are real happy to be there, but that's about it. Versus 100 acres of woods with all kinds of diverse plants, we're talking, we started the show, they said over 1,000 insects. We've got over 25,000 species of insects in the state. So there's a lot of different critters out there in the like. So, I understand your concern. I will tell you, though, at least I feel reasonably comfortable most of the time that there are people looking at this. And if you can find a problem and have the data, usually you can make an adjustment to get products pulled off the market.
Tom, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Marlis in Cambridge. Hi, Marlis.
Hello. I'm just wondering if there could be a change in the venom that hornets and such critters have. I'm a gardener, but I'm 76 years old. I've been stung in the past without any big problem. And about a month ago, I was stung in the back of the neck by something. Since it got me behind my head, I have no idea what got me. But it was a sting, and it hurt immediately. But I had, within about 5 minutes, I had anaphylaxis. I had to go to the emergency room. They kept me for 4 hours. I was a wreck. And could it be that these insects have stronger venom, or maybe it's simply that an older person, somebody 76, is more susceptible than when they were younger? What do you think?
I don't know if it's so much stronger venom. The first question, bees are different than wasps and how we react to them. So it could have been that you just have never experienced the particular critter that got you. More often than not, and again, I go back to what's more likely to sting, we find people have yellow jacket allergies just because they, by nature, just have a bad disposition and are often in close contact with people. Whereas what we define as true bees are much more docile creatures and much less likely. And so, that's always tough because each critter has somewhat different venom. And as I said, the yellow jacket group you could be susceptible to and you'd not be susceptible to bumblebees or even vice versa. But I think the common, as we age, I think there is a chance of being, really it's just your body overreacting to what's going on there. And maybe that isn't as much age-related as your body can, after three or four stings, all of a sudden say, that's enough, and react in a much more severe manner, and then you unfortunately have that kind of medical issue. And so I'm sure they've told you you've got to be careful now, and you might even get the point that your doctor might suggest an EpiPen just so you've got something around in case you get another exposure.
Yeah, good advice. Marlis, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Michael emailed us. He just saw a wine glass insect about the size of a carpenter ant crawling fast across his driveway. Its abdomen was raised straight upward, displaying yellow and black stripes underneath. The rest of the body was brown. Any ideas?
My first guess is Rove beetle, R-O-V-E. This is an interesting group of beetles because they don't look like beetles. They're long and skinny and don't have the hard wing covers. And there are some that are somewhat marked that way in a characteristic, not of all, but some of them, is to run with their abdomen sticking up. So that's my first guess. To be honest, if I pondered, I probably could come up with another couple critters. It does not sound ant-like, both because of the markings. And although there are some ants that will raise their abdomen, as I said, I bet you it was just a Rove beetle.
All right. Let's go to Sue in La Crosse then. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Bald-faced hornet. I think that's what they are. They're around my bird feeders, and what happens is, you know, I have hummingbird feeders, and then, of course, put out jelly. Is that accurate? And they're really aggressive in chewing the birds away.
Yeah, bald-faced hornet is the critter that makes those giant paper wasp nests that you see in the fall when they come out of the trees. You know, the leaves come out of the trees and they're more. The populations will continue to build till about mid-September, and then they start to go in a decline. But I don't figure we're out of the bald-faced hornet season until we get well in towards the end of October. And they are scavengers. You know, they feed on houseflies and other things among, but they also have a bit of a sweet tooth. It's tough unless, you know, there are some designs and feeders that prevent yellow jackets, and this is very closely related to the yellow jackets, from getting access to things. But if things are out in the open, they can literally tell other nest mates that there's free food there. And so they literally recruit, much like ants do. And so over time, things will probably get somewhat worse just because, again, the time of the year, the numbers build, and also that they know there is a food source there. And, boy, other than, again, trying to restrict their access, which makes it a little more difficult for the birds, I know, I just don't know any way of beating them. It's usually not practical to find the nest because it could be 200 yards away, 20 feet up in a tree type of thing. And so, as I said, I know it gets quite frustrating. More often than not, you know, if they're on the food source and you mess with them, I can see where they get aggressive. If they just flying by you, they're not going to go out of their way to sting you. But I think, you know, they're approaching the birds as a competitor for food, and that's probably why they're getting somewhat agitated and also trying to drive the birds off.
Yeah. Kathy in Presque Isle, on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. So I have a question about the Colorado potato beetle. I'm in a community garden, and one of the gardeners has the beetle on his potato plants, and they have pretty much decimated his plants. And I grow potatoes a couple gardens, a couple plots over, and so far they haven't hit mine, but I'm being watchful. But I'm wondering, for next year, do those beetles overwinter, or how do they find our plants, and is there anything to prevent them from getting them?
Yeah, so they overwinter as adults. They burrow down into the soil somewhat and then emerge in the spring. And what's interesting is they typically go in fence rows and wood edges and the like where there's more litter. So there was a study done way back in New Jersey where they had these big potato fields, and they literally would dig trenches around the very outside. And in the spring of the year, these beetles would be crawling from those overwintering sites to their potatoes as they came out. Now, they also feed on weeds that are in the potato family, so there's other plants out there. And what they found is they could trap a number of the adults before things got in that help. But in a lot of cases, it's not practical. I think you have been lucky enough they have not found you yet. But I find the best way to deal with this critter, they have two generations a year. We're well into the second generation now. And if you catch those overwintering adults when they come on the plants in early June and shut the door, usually you can win the war. You have to be observant, though. Whether you every couple days go out there and turn the leaves over to look for their eggs, which are orange and very easy to see, or you see the first beetles. And then there's some products, including some organic products, that can be sprayed to knock them down. Or you can hand-pick them, although, you know, if you got a lot of potatoes, hand-picking is going to be somewhat limited in effectiveness. But to me, it's being aware that you catch that first wave coming in. You know, people who are lucky enough to have access to a lot of land can rotate away from them. You know, if you told me you could go 400 yards away and replant, you'd be okay until they found you. But once they find you, they don't seem to want to go away. They, you know, the population's somewhat self-sustained. Although, again, in my observations, Colorado potato beetle has been less of a home garden pest in the last 10 years versus what it was 30 or 40 years ago. That's a weird dynamic that I don't really understand. But definitely I got far less calls. But once you got them, as I said, they seem to become reappearing. And so that's when I get in, you know, thinking about when they're first showing up and seeing if I can stop them before they lay eggs and start that first generation. And then you can often get home free. It's harder to catch up with second generation anyway, because there's all kinds of life stages. There are critters in the ground. There's eggs. There's larvae. And there's no one life stage that can be treated and take care of everything. But in the spring of the year, they're all just adults coming on. And so that's when you got the best opportunity.
Kathy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jennifer and Scott from Monona emailed us. They have a hole in the yard, which bees fly in and out of. They tried using the garden hose to get rid of the bees, and they thought the rain earlier in the week would make them leave. Any other suggestions? Yeah. Are these minor bees?
These are our yellow jackets. These are a ground nesting form of yellow jacket. And we do not want to use the lawnmower close by, because they will get very grumpy. They don't flood out very well, basically because they're using old rodent burrows in most cases that are designed in a way that they drain. And so I also have limited faith in the wasp and hornet sprays, because those work great for things that you can see in nests that are above ground, but for below ground, not so much. So I've had the best luck by far. In fact, I just gave my son-in-law a canister of dust insecticide to treat the exact same thing in his yard. He's got a hole about the size of a softball. The recommendation is wait until the evening or right away in the morning. And for a hole that big, to be honest, I like the idea of stuffing a rag to restrict the opening. And I just dust the opening with 7 garden dust, or really any of the garden dust should be sufficient. Dust work better because the critters come in contact when they come in and out of the nest. And as I said, if you restrict the hole, you even got more likelihood they'll come into contact with it. And remember to treat, again, in the evening. In an ideal world, you'd have a cool evening to do it, but in the summer, that's not very practical. If you leave it be, it will continue to increase in numbers for at least the next 2 to 3 weeks. You can consider trying getting enough dirt and filling it in. That works some of the time, but my experience, if it's a big, strong nest, they literally will dig another hole out or dig their way through. And so, as I said, it is an option, but you got to realize that it isn't 100%. And definitely the water part, it just, as I said, those old rodent burrows are designed that the water doesn't flood where the nest is in particular. And that's the problem with the sprays, too. You're just spraying the entrance. It gets bound up in the soil, whereas the dusts are coating that, and that's what they catch when they go in and out.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're looking at insects on the show today with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate at UW-Madison. Always great to have Phil stop by. And lots of callers online, lots of emails. Let's go to Sue and Rhinelander next. Sue, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a problem with, I believe they're bald-faced hornets. And I had knocked a nest down up on the roof, but This is the second year. Those things have, they're in my house. I don't know. I can't find where they're getting in. And last fall, I was killing a few of them all through the winter. They were real docile, and I could grab a paper towel and squish them against the window. But this spring is different, and I got stung once in the house, and there's also seem to have babies. I saw one last night crawling on the couch arm, which I killed it, and one that was on the carpet. They're about half the size. Now, they're about an inch long, and I've tried a lot of things. I've put peppermint out, got spearmint plants growing, and nothing seems to be working. And I would like to find a way to permanently remove them.
Okay, permanent is going to be an issue, but let me explain a couple things. There are two different species, at least. Anytime you see a yellow jacket or wasp, they're adults. They no longer grow. So if you have two different sizes, you have two different species. And there is no question in my mind that they are either nesting in your attic or nesting in your walls. And they come and go, and they get mixed up sometimes. And so, you know, a nest outside, they have no business being in your house. When you see wasps in your house, you know they're nesting indoors. The frustration is going to be is we need to know where the nest is. And the only thing I can suggest, again, especially in the late summer when their numbers are higher, is just to quietly walk around outside and watch along your soffits, your overhangs, and you should see a pattern. You should see critters coming and going in enough numbers that it gets your attention. If we find that, then we can take care of them because you can treat that opening, and I would definitely treat it before I'd seal it. If you seal it, what happens is the critters in your walls or attic decide to come down because they get desperate. This also would suggest what happened this winter is that the workers all starve out. The new queens, which are responsible for starting the nest next year, find places to hide. And out in nature, that's under rocks and then under tree bark and the like. But they also can overwinter in attics. And, of course, because your house warms things up, they get all mixed up. They think it's spring even in January, and you'll see one come through. But they're on limited energy reserves. You know, there's nothing to eat at that time of the year. And so they really often are quite docile, as you said. But the problem is every year the colonies start from scratch with a new queen. And although they're not known to come back to the same spot necessarily, if you've got some in the neighborhood, it's not surprising that you've run into this problem more than once. But as I said, right now, I don't know of any easy solution because there's no bait that works. You can kill the ones you see. Those are just workers, but you're not at the nest. As I said, what I would do is just walk around. Now, sometimes there's a pattern. If they seem to be mostly in the bathroom, that tells you what side of the house where you've got to look and the like. If there's no pattern at all, I honestly would think the attic, and they're coming down through your light fixtures. And that, you know, at least gives you something to look at. And then you check that, you know, make sure your soffits are screened and other things to prevent this in the future. But boy, unless we have a hint where the nest is, it's going to be very frustrating because you just can't get to the spot that's going to do any good.
Good luck, Sue. Appreciate your call. That's a tough one. Tim in Kenosha, we give you a chance. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Larry. Seems like a lot of ball-faced hornet calls. I'm a beekeeper by hobby, and I was coming out of my honey house, closed the door, and I had honey on my hands and apparently some on my watch. I've got a distinctive watch with a stainless steel band, so it's kind of easy to see. Anyway, a ball-faced hornet flew down and landed on my watch and started licking honey, and you know, I just watched it and kind of enjoyed it, and then he shook it away, and I went away, and had breakfast, left for a while, came back, and I was having lunch on my front porch quite a ways away from my honey house, and the ball-faced hornet showed up again, landed on my watch, and there wasn't any honey on it then, and it flew off. The next day, it found me again and landed on my watch. I know honeybees are pretty savvy about communicating and recognizing things visually, but I'm pretty ignorant about ball-faced hornets or hornets in general, and I was just shocked. I just have a question. I Have you seen that sort of behavior before? That were there?
Not to that extreme, although, you know, I had a colleague, Dr. Bob Jean, who studied yellow jacket behavior and the like, and he definitely could prove they're not as fancy as honeybees, but yellow jackets could communicate to nest mates when they found a food source. But there seems to be something more going on. I wonder if something visual with a watch that's really got them interested, because, as I said, you know, it's not as if they had been doing this every day for a week to kind of get in the habit of knowing that associate the food with the watch and in an area. I mean, you know, it just seems more, I mean, it's hard to argue statistically if you got three different bald-faced hornets showing up in your watch that there isn't something going on there. But as I said, I just don't know how they could communicate, and that wouldn't be, it would be the food source more so than the visual side, but I don't know. That's a very interesting observation.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim, for calling. Really interesting. Kellen Sugar Camp, your turn. Hi, Kel.
Hi. I always love Phil on the show because you always teach us lots of new things. I really love it when you're on. My question is, how come I'm not hearing any cicadas? I'm just not hearing any cicadas. Usually by August, I'm hearing cicadas.
Yeah. We started hearing them around here somewhat on the early side. But I will tell you, I have not heard one today, and I should be, would suggest their numbers are down. Now, in just conversations with friends and whatnot, you know, down in the southern part of the state, we have cicada killer wasps out, and they go on forage on cicadas, and I've heard their numbers seem to be up in some places, but that doesn't explain it. I wonder if it's just a dynamic. I wouldn't think the dry weather would affect it because they are root feeders on plants. Trees in particular, but yeah, I think I agree with you. I heard some early, but nothing like what I would consider a normal summer, where I expect to hear them singing well into September. In fact, I always used to tease my kids when they were small is that's the first call to go back to school when the cicadas come out. As I said, it's interesting because I agree with you. Just when I think about it now, I did not hear any this morning when I was outside. And the like, and I should. It's a perfect day. It's nice and sunny and warm enough. There's no reason they shouldn't be singing if they're there.
Yeah. There you go, Kel. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Now, I will mention, Larry, that, you know, the 17-year cicadas are going to come out in Wisconsin next year.
Yeah.
You know, in the southern part of the state, Lake Geneva and the like, around Mazamani. They're not everywhere. They're not in the Madison area, but not that far away. And so that will be a special treat. And they're earlier. They're May and into early June is when we see that activity.
Desmond in Stevens Point will give you a chance. Hi, Desmond.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show. I have a question about Japanese beetles. I got a dwarf cherry tree earlier this season, and I'm just keeping it in its pot right now, and it's been attacked by Japanese beetles. I've been managing to pick them off, and it probably only lost about 7% of its foliage or so. And I'm curious, I guess if I put it in the ground, is this something that I'm going to have to commit to every summer, fighting back these bugs, or is there some point where I can just kind of leave them alone? And also, do you have any suggestions as far as preventative care and maintenance?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that makes gardening frustrating because you have a plant that is on their preferred to eat list. You know, they come flying in from down the road, so I can't give you anything magical you can do in your yard to prevent them from coming. The only sliver of good news I can give you is, in my own experience with Japanese beetle in Madison, is back around 2000, it was like a science fiction movie. We did not have a birch tree in the neighborhood, a cherry tree in the neighborhood, a rose bush in the neighborhood that wasn't 90% defoliated. This year, I have seen three beetles total all summer long. And that's the experience, is they come on like gangbusters, they make your life miserable for a few years, but then they dissipate. Another thing you might experience is, if the numbers are somewhat on the low side, if you can have them find something else to eat early, they leave you alone. We know that when they eat on plants, they attract other Japanese beetles, both because of the damage leaves give volatiles and the beetles give off chemicals. In the story I used to tell about, I used to have a potentilla bush in the front of the house that I never saw a yellow flower on because the beetles would eat all the flowers off. Well, I normally don't spray for things, but this time I got mad for something else, and I sprayed that bush early in July when the first wave came. I never saw another beetle on those plants. Now, my neighbor's Cotonia aster hedge did not do so well because that's what they started to gang up on. And so you see that experience sometimes. The other thing, and this may be counter-effective, they like plants out in the sun. And so things that are in the shade during the afternoon tend to be somewhat less attractive to them than things out in the sun. Now, of course, plants need sunlight, so that doesn't always work. But you will notice sometimes in your yard, the difference of feeding has to do with where the sun hits in the afternoon.
There you go. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Phil. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mailer here with my guest entomologist Phil Pelletieri. It's always great to have Phil stop by, and of course he's been answering many questions from you about insects. And if you'd like to join in, you can call at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Phil, Pam emailed us a picture. She saw this bug on the edge of the woods on her farm in southwestern Wisconsin. Looks to be a black bug. Have you seen it?
I'm just calling it up now. Ah, okay. It is a immature stink bug, or what we would call a nymph. And what makes it difficult is the adult is going to be different color. It probably is going to be a total green insect. But the immature stages have those very interesting markings, almost colorful. Yeah, nothing to worry about. If you saw a bunch of them, stink bugs do feed on plants in some cases, although some are feed on other insects, but I wouldn't worry. And again, if I had to make a wild guess, that's just an immature green stink bug.
Bill in Oregon emailed us with another question. They've had a healthy local population of green halicted bees for many years. This summer, there are barely any around. He wonders if they're susceptible to drought or is something else happening.
Well, I'm not familiar with their biology enough to be sure it's drought related. But, you know, the ebbs and flows of spring weather, winter weather and whatnot, how they affect things. I would guess it's some weather dynamic, but I'm not so sure we can blame it on drought versus, you know, the exact weather when the adults were starting to become active. Sometimes, you know, a bad storm at that time or a freeze at the bad time really does affect populations.
He also had a crazy-looking insect land on his shirt last week. It had the abdomen of a wasp and the arms of a praying mantis. A bit of research said it was the first sighting of a wasp matted fly.
Well, I don't know. It depends on the site. I have seen those in the state before. It definitely does seem to be a mantid fly, which, again, has characteristics of a wasp, but it's not a wasp at all. It's a unique group of insects. And, you know, anytime you see those big gangly front legs, you know it's a predator of some sort because it uses that to catch its prey.
Let's go to Nina in Menasha. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
And all your different guests. I'm just calling to share my discovery of how to safely and non-toxic way of deterring those Asian beetles. I think that's what they are. They're the little imposter ladybugs. Is that an Asian beetle?
Right. And so, honestly, talking to PJ this morning, I have a fear that their numbers are going to be up this year because they are aphid feeders. There's lots of aphids. the secret is the first hard freeze, whether it's September or October, is when they start coming in. And either you have them sealed up so they can't get underneath your siding and in your soffits so they don't get in the house, or there are various sprays, including you could even use pyrethrum, which is a natural insecticide. The trouble with pyrethrum is it only lasts for a few hours at best, and to be honest, your house has to be protected probably for 2 to 3 weeks during the potential time of these things coming in. It's never productive to spray indoors just because they've already gotten your walls, you've lost the battle. So if you're inclined to use sprays, you spray on the outside, especially the sunny sides of the house, and if you air, you air high, not low. Asian lady beetle traps that use pheromones. To be honest, the research data I have seen has not been very impressive. You don't catch enough of them to make a difference, and so I would probably not go that direction.
Yeah.
Again, usually what we try to get people to think about is if you solve the riddle on how they're getting in and crawling up underneath things and get that sealed, you know, steel wooled, any way of physically keeping them out, you have a permanent solution. You know, they're not getting in, you don't have a problem in the future. If you're inclined to use sprays, and, you know, in some houses you have to have it commercially sprayed because it's just not possible to cover the areas with the equipment that most people have, that's still an annual fall application. No need to treat in the spring. The ones that wake up in the spring are leaving, so just let them leave type of thing. But as I said, it's a good time to call because we've got at least 3 to 4 weeks before they potentially are coming in, and it might even be a couple months. It just depends on how the weather goes.
Yeah. And Nina, you had your own method for getting rid of them?
It was an accident. Okay, I'm not doing a plug for Lever. Lever 2000, the bar soap. There's three kinds. There is a original and then a blue color and a green color. The original, the white bar, they hate it. If you put it in your camper, it smells good. It's better than mothballs. It also keeps away rodents, and it won't hurt your pets or your children. I leave it in the box, and I poke holes, and I stick them in the garage. I won't find any of those little beetles. I accidentally left a bag in my garage, and there was a circle, a complete clean circle with no Asian beetles on it, and that's what gave me the clue. And I've shared it with people with campers, with vintage cars, and it smells good, but it's the white bar. I just wanted to share that because I put it out on my patio, and I don't have any. They don't come in the house or anything.
Well, so, you know, definitely there's an awful lot going on with natural plant oils being repellent to insects. You know, the problem is if you just had the plant oil, I would bet that would degrade, but I can see in the bar soap where it would stay intact long enough. So that's an interesting observation. It'd be interesting to see what the difference, if they listed an active ingredients, to see if you could identify what are the component of the soap. You know, soaps in themselves are insecticidal, but generally not for thick-bodied critters like beetles. They're for more soft-bodied things. And this sounds more like a repellency than a killing type of product. So that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, and what was the name of the soap again?
2000, and get the bar soap. I mean, you can get a big, like a 5-pack for $10 or something. It's worth every penny.
And what was it again? I just didn't get the name.
Oh, Lever 2000, but make sure it is the white, the original bar.
Okay.
They don't seem to like the blue or the green as much. I mean, it doesn't work as well as the original.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Nina. Appreciate it. Let's go to Eric in Rice Lake. Hi, Eric.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. A couple of weeks ago, maybe 2-3 weeks ago, in a wooded area, I noticed a little piece of fuzz, like an eighth of an inch or smaller, just snow white, floating through the air. And I went to grab it, and it was a tiny, tiny insect, just as snow white as could be, and just imperceptibly small, floating on the breeze. I saw 5 or 6 of them that day. Any suggestion, Phil, as to what that would be?
Sure. Critter is called a woolly alder aphid. And it literally secretes this white filament, and you get a bunch of those, so it gives you this impression of this little fuzz ball. And it jumps between maples and alders. You know, a lot of aphids have two different plants depending on the time of the year they do their thing. And it's kind of a classic. There are other woolly aphids, but what makes woolly alder aphid distinct is the filaments are so long, as I said, it gets this real fuzzball thing rather than looking like just a critter that's got a little bit of white coating on it. And a neat critter. I've seen some great photographs of them sitting on a leaf because they said they're bizarre looking things. And then you look real carefully and you see the tiny little legs and whatnot of the aphid body. But the filaments are 4 to 5 times longer than the critter itself.
It's really interesting. Eric, thanks. Appreciate it. Diane in Hubbleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Diane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in a rural area with thousands and millions of box elder bugs. And instead of spraying in the house, what I would am trying to attack them outside and using Dawn dish soap and water in kind of a handheld industrial sprayer. I know that I have killed tens of thousands since spring. How far of a radius around the house do I need to go? Because directly across the street from us are a bunch of trees I haven't touched.
Sure. The unfortunate thing is they can come from 100 yards away. And now the thing to remember about the soap is it really doesn't last long. It's great as a contact kill. And one of my favorite Larry Mueller stories, we were doing this show, it's got to be 30 years ago, and somebody called in and said, I tried Cheer and it didn't work. And it turns out soap chemistries differ, and we know Dawn has the stuff that works. There is a product called insecticidal soap that works. It's got the right fatty acid components in there that make it insecticidal, but not all soaps are equal is what I'm really saying. So, you know, the only thing you can do, and it's going to intensify because when they start looking for sheltered sites in the next couple, 3 weeks, they're going to be migrating. And the time to kill them is like you're doing spraying the outside when they're congregating, especially in the mornings when they're kind of clustered, and keep doing it. But realize if you spray today, you might have to be out there in a couple more days and spray again. Again, any trees that are on your property you can spray that are fine, but they do move. It just depends on how many sheltered sites they can find before they get to your house. You know, in nature, they crawl under the bark of trees and those kind of things. But I've seen cases where buildings have been, as I said, 200 yards away, and usually it's more when you got big fields, and then the woods are quite a distance away that those stinkers will fly all the way from those trees onto the house.
Diane, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kim in Winona, Minnesota, we go to you next. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. We have little tiny black spiders. They're mostly coming out. You see them in the bathtub and the drain, but the other night there were like 3 of them on my bed. I don't know. Are they coming up from the drains, or how do we get rid of these guys?
Boy, spiders get tough in that, you know, spiders don't thrive indoors because there's not a lot of critters to eat, but that doesn't mean you don't get them. If I had to guess, it's either in your wall voids, your attic, or your basement. Probably not the drain because there's no way, you know, drains are too tight and spiders don't like water by nature. They do respond to ant sprays. But you honestly got to get back in the nooks and crannies of the basement, the corners where their spiders are hiding to work. If you'd rather not use sprays, one of the things you can help reduce the numbers to some degree, they sell these little devices. We call them glue boards. They sell bigger devices for catching mice and the like where it's sticky and the mouse gets caught on it. Well, insects get caught on glue boards too. In fact, in food handling establishments, we often use those as monitoring traps, where you put them on windowsills and other things. Now, you got to be careful if you got a cat, because if the cat gets into the glue board, now you got a sticky mess to deal with. But they're a way of physically reducing insect numbers. So the same thing, you can put them down in the basement back in these corners. When the spiders are crawling around, they get caught on it, and that will help reduce the numbers. Now, what might be encouraging, if there are a bunch of little spiders, I wonder if you just had a hatch. You know, a spider egg case can have 50, 70 eggs. And if they all hatch at once, you got lots of little spiders running around. But the chance of those spiders taking hold and continuing breeding in the house is pretty small, just because, like I said, it's not good habitat. There's just not enough stuff to eat in the house versus outside where there's lots of insects.
Kim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Alden in Madison purchased a home out in a cabin out in Maine, and when got there, discovered a small amount of dust in a little pile, and it looks like powder post beetle dust. Now worried about whether or not the powder post beetles are going to heat up his cabin.
Sure. So powder post beetles do better in cabins and the like that are not heated in the winter. What happens in our climate is we dry our wood out so much it's not suitable in year-round homes. But old barns and cabins that are only heated occasionally, the moisture level comes up. So that's part of the game. Now, a way of insect-proofing wood is to use a boric acid solution that is painted on the wood, and it soaks in, and when the beetles feed on it, they die. The problem is that this works when the wood is unfinished, but if it's painted or sealed in any manner, the borates don't go in. Sometimes you're lucky enough to find it's only, in fact, more likely than not, it's only one or two borates, because even in a given log, it might only be one corner. It has to do with the starch and moisture content within the wood, if it's a good place or a bad place for them to be. So it might just be that you can kind of spot treat the areas that are problematic. You might have to do a little sanding. You can literally paint the borates on with a paintbrush and let it soak in, and then seal over it if you want. And that will stop them. The main thing is sit back and assess it. Give it some time. You know, it's not like you've got to do anything in the next month, even the next 6 months. It isn't going to make a difference. So really kind of assess where you're at and see what makes the most sense. And don't overreact. I would argue that if things are really bad with powder post beetle, that structure has a significant moisture problem. That's the only thing that kind of fuels the fire, is the more moisture you've got, the happier the critters are. And so sometimes addressing the moisture issues are as, if not more important than dealing with the critters themselves.
Mm. Debbie in Oconomowoc will give you a chance. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, thank you very much. I have a question about Japanese beetles. I don't know if it was through this program or gardening seminar that I thought I heard someone say that what the Japanese beetles grow up eating, that's kind of what they seek out as they go along. And I have elm, like a couple elm strips, and then some wild grape that I leave in my garden. I have a lot of gardens, but they do seem to go there. And I don't know if it's just that I'm lucky or if that's really true, that they seek out certain, I mean, they don't touch anything in my garden other than the stuff that I've left for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, definitely grape is one of the things. If they're going to eat anything in your yard, it's going to be grape. In fact, that's the first way of assessing if they're in the neighborhood, I think. And you'll see differences. It sounds like your numbers aren't too high. You know, one of the plants that we have trouble with on occasion is basil. And if they're really in big numbers, we have a problem. And as I had related earlier in the show, I've seen three Japanese beetles in my whole neighborhood. Our basil has not seen one. But that's because the populations are so low here. How long have you had Japanese beetles that you know of on your property?
Probably about 7-8 years. And they came real late this year. And I mean, I don't consider it a huge number. I mean, they're enough to be annoying. Mm-hmm. But it seems to keep them happy if I just kind of leave them a little area to feed on. They don't touch my flowers.
No, as I had related earlier, they definitely is this relationship that when they start ganging up on something, they stay on it. And again, if they're going to show up on anything, so if you can, the wild grapes, you know, that's no big deal. And, you know, I'm hoping that you're in a place where it is just not conducive for high numbers. The reason we had so much trouble in my neighborhood is I'm about 2 blocks from a golf course, and, you know, we have seen populations as high as 100 grubs per square foot in a golf course. So you can only imagine the sheer number of insects, and then they fly down the road. And as I said, that's why you look at it biologically. It's just a nightmare to get rid of them on a large scale. It's not practical. But what we think is going on is, honestly, there are some natural diseases that have moved in, and that's why in the Madison area their populations have been so low, as these diseases are naturally controlling a majority of the population. But it takes time for that stuff to kick in. And as I said, to me, it's at least a 10 or 12-year cycle in most cases. And the people I feel the most sympathy for are they're just starting to see them, and they have no idea how bad they can get under the right conditions.
Mm. Debbie, thank you for calling. Tim in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
I have a question. Was wondering if you have any information about a striped flea beetle that's feeding on garlic mustard.
There have been, this is one that I guess I'd say I know I'm not 100% up to date, but there were three or four insects that have been in the laboratory being investigated for release for garlic mustard control. Even with that said, before, and these, as far as I'm aware of, have not received USDA clearance to be released in a natural setting. With that being said, though, that I have seen and had in the years, you know, before I retired in the lab, people would send garlic mustard that was being defoliated by plants, including flea beetles, which are a type of leaf beetle. But in order to really be effective in most cases when you've got an insect that's feeding on a plant, it has to be almost exclusive. And here's the problem with releasing things. You know, if we get something that, aside from feeding on garlic mustard, starts feeding on people's broccoli plants, you can see why you can't possibly, you know, release that critter. And that's been why they were reluctant. The critters they have, as far as I'm aware, did not have a restricted enough food base to make it go. So it'd be interesting, you know, if you ever do see the things, or I bet if you did a search on flea beetles and garlic mustard, you'd pick up some references to names of critters. And it wouldn't surprise me that they are native flea beetles, and they just happen to feed on it. But that being said, I bet you, even though it cosmetically looks good, the unfortunate thing when you defoliate a plant, you can take 40-50% leaves and you do not affect the plant's production in most cases. It's got to get above that. And so unless it eats it to the ground, it's not eating enough is the unfortunate thing.
Tim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Phil, here we are out of time once again. I want to thank you so much. As you said, we've been doing this a long time together, and I hope we can continue to do that. Thanks, Phil.
Okay, take care.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guest today. Always a pleasure to have him with us. I just wanted to remind you that our next book club book, it's called Art of the Break, a novel about maturing, letting go, and moving forward. And the story involves cheese making. And we're going to be talking about that with the author, Milwaukee resident Mary Wimmer, on August 24th. So if I'm not mistaken, that's next week, on Thursday of next week. So if you haven't gotten the book yet, grab a copy. I've really enjoyed reading it, and I'm sure you will as well. And we'll be interviewing Mary on Thursday, August 24th. So looking forward to that. Coming up tomorrow on the Larry Miller Show, attorney Michael Riley's back to answer your questions about legal issues, maybe insurance issues, class action lawsuits, or simply finding a lawyer. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Miller.